Well, hello, friends. Welcome to Voices of the Sacred Feminine. It is Wednesday, so you know we will be here. And thank you for tuning in today, live or possibly from the archives, where I believe most of you actually listen from. You know, as I've said before, you are the gas in my tank. So please do keep your comments coming in and your show ideas. And, you know, that's how we've managed to sustain here for the last 13 years and, you know, growing with, you know, more and more downloads and sharing important information that, you know, we don't necessarily have access to unless we know the right questions to ask or we go to the right sources. I know for one, growing up in the Bible Belt of New Orleans, a lot of the stuff that I've shared here on the show over the years, there was no way in the world I would have found out about any of this stuff had I continued to live there and be in the bubbles that I grew up in and was in as an adult. So, it is my pleasure to be, you know, raising awareness, you know, with all the wonderful guests that I believe I've had on the show over the years. And today's guest is no exception. We have with us Reverend Louis Valadez. He was with us last week, and we had a show about the dangers of dominionist Christianity and the Opus Dei, which are factions of Christianity many of our top politicians are involved in today. So many in the Republican Party or supporters of the Republican Party or this dangerous, you know, dominionist Christianity sect in ideology. And, you know, we did have a little bit of response from last week's show, you know, people in disbelief. And, you know, that's why I think the show was so important because this is not something that's well known out there in the world. And that's the whole point of last week's show and today's show. Now, today's show, we're going to continue about some aspects of Christianity you might not be aware of. Again, I didn't learn about this until the last few years, quite frankly. I believe the first person that tipped me off to it was actually a German psychologist. His name was Erich Fromm. I think he wrote the book. I think the title is To Have or To Be, or maybe it's To Be or To Have, one or the other. He's the first one that tipped me off about the links between Christianity and capitalism. And then there was Monica Hsu, who wrote The Cosmic Mother. She wrote a little bit about it as well. And I've done some blog posts. You know, some of the foremothers in the women's spirituality movement, well, you know, they haven't exactly come out and said this, which in a way is a little bit of a disappointment. You know, some of these women are my mentors, you know, Merlin Stone, Rhianne Eisler. But it's, you know, I wonder why they have not actually gone here. You know, as feminists, I feel like, you know, they've been struggling for decades for women to get a piece of the pie. But, you know, women have ended up with a patriarchal, capitalistic piece of the pie. And is that really what we wanted? So anyway, I'm so glad to have Reverend Louis Valadez with me, who is going to bring this all to the fore. Chris Hedges has also written about this as well. You can probably Google some of his articles out there. But anyhow, just to sort of reiterate what today's topic is, we're going to examine the links between Christianity and capitalism. We'll learn about the shift from pre-Christian tribalism and community sharing to the rise of capitalistic thinking and what the early Christian links, you know, to in the early Christianity's links to communism and socialism. So we're going to look at this unholy alliance between Christianity and capitalism. And look closer at what socialism really is. And I think it's really important right now, as it would appear, that the presidential election coming up this year is going to be between Bernie Sanders, a Democratic socialist, and Biden, who is a centrist, a corporatist, and in my opinion, someone is just going to keep offering us the crumbs of incrementalism. And where has that gotten the middle class over the last few decades? So anyway, Biden's even, on record saying that they would negotiate with Republicans to, give away more Social Security. Is that like really what we need? Elderly people are living in poverty now. So anyway, that's sort of a side conversation we could have, but I want to go ahead and welcome Reverend Valadez to the show, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about him again, just in case you weren't with us last week, but I do encourage you to go listen to the February 26th interview. So Reverend Louis Valadez, he's better known in the neo-pagan and witchcraft communities as Oracle. He's a neo-pagan minister, and he's been initiated in a number of esoteric traditions. He is a druid in two druid orders, an initiate in the Strega family of the late Dr. Leo Martello. He's an elder in the Minoan Brotherhood and the Alexandrian tradition of Wicca. He's a founder and high priest of the Temple of Hecate, and he's currently ordained through the Church of All Worlds. And this is important, he is also a former licensed and ordained Christian minister. Yes, let me say that again. He's a former licensed and ordained Christian minister, so he knows what he's talking about. He's lived it. but he's rejected it now and moved on. He's currently studying for his bachelor's degree in alternative medicine, and he's concentrating on nutritional therapy, and he's the author of a forthcoming book titled Strixcraft, Ancient Greek Magic for the Modern Witch, which Llewellyn is going to publish this year. So, Reverend Valadez, thank you for returning to Voices of the Sacred Feminine today.
Thank you again for having me. I had a lot of fun last week in encouraging people to understand the dangers of dominionism and hopefully opening their eyes to the dangers that their denominations are encouraging. And I know there was a lot of pushback on it, but, education is power, knowledge is power, and I was really glad for some of the conversations I even had in person.
Yeah, and I'm trying to think, isn't there a saying out there, first they fight you, then they laugh at you, then you win, or something like that. That's kind of a little foggy in my mind, but, I believe that. These ideas that, we're sharing with people, maybe it upsets their apple cart, it rubs them the wrong way because maybe they've never heard it before. But I think, it's important to kind of blaze a trail. I've often said, I feel like I'm out there with my pink-handled machete, blazing a path, trying to clear the way, for some of these ideas we talk about here on the show. And it's not always easy, but, eventually people do come around.
They do. It takes a while because people are so entrenched in their belief systems, and there's this idea that psychological base where the more emotion is tied to belief in the brain, and so the more you emotionally invest yourself in a philosophy or belief system, and the more pushback you get, the more entrenched you will be, and into your own systems until something comes along and says, and you're able to open your mind and say a little bit, perhaps this is what's going on. But it takes the individual themselves to really take that step, which is very scary. I know it was for me when I first stepped out of the Christian church. It was very scary for me. It was very unknown. I had no idea what to do. My paradigm was shaken. I had no holy book to guide me, supposedly. It's supposed to guide you and be the fence around the life, the perimeter of your life. So to have that pulled out from under me, the rug, so to speak, is very was very traumatic. And so I can understand why some people would not want to do it, because it is a very traumatic issue.
Yeah, I mean, oftentimes, you know, I liken this to the Matrix movie series. You know, you're either going to take the red pill or the blue pill, and I forget now which pill is which, but you're either going to continue to live in your safe bubble where, you know, none of your ideas are challenged, or you're going to have the courage, because it does take courage, you know, to see reality for what it is. And, you know, oftentimes it's more than people can handle, I think.
Yes, it can. You know, and the Matrix is, you know, comparison is so true, because it's spot on. Because, you know, you have to step out and you have to be able to look at yourself honestly and objectively, which is very difficult when you carry this mask that's been forcefully put on you, almost like the Man in the Iron Mask. You know, this mask that's been forcefully put on you and you're being hidden away in doctrine. And this idea that, oh my gosh, you know, I need to be freed, and you forget what you look like and you forget what life is about. I've had some pushback, some comments on it in person to say, you know, well, you know, I am open, I am this, I am that. And it's like, well, are you sure? Because if you were, you'd really be looking at the objective of your church or of your denomination or of your, you know, political alliances, which is why I'm excited to talk about today, the political alliances. But yeah, it's, again, it's a very traumatic thing. It shakes you to the core. And a lot of people are coming out of it, but there are still some people, unfortunately. Most people are trapped in it, as we can see from the numbers of evangelicals and others from denominations that are married to the political capitalist and dominionist ideals.
Yeah, and, you know, and we should probably say that, you know, all Christians aren't dominionists. There are a lot of great Christians out there, progressive Christians who are working hard to make the world a better place. You know, I sort of tend to call them the Jesus Christians, you know, and, you know, I even had some pushback from some people who said they knew Pentecostals and were nothing like this. And as we talked about before the show started, that could be true. We weren't painting all Pentecostals with the same brush, but you might not know your friends who are Christians or into this, or it might have been a Pentecostal group that didn't, you know, go down this dominionist road. Would you say that's accurate, Lewis?
That is accurate. You know, they don't know, or there's no name to the system. They may be they may believe in the system that the Pentecostal churches or whatever or what have you, that specific church, they may believe these things, but of course, you know, there is no name for it. They would not call themselves Dominionists. They would not call themselves Deliverance Ministries. These are outsider names that we give to them to label them and you know, what they really are, because many of the churches object to these labels. Oh, no, we're not like that. But you are. That's what you are. It's almost like racist. I'm not racist, but no, you are a racist. And so people object often to the labels that are given to them, but these are accurate. And a lot of it is ignorance. Ignorance as to what are the warning signs that your church is like this? What are the warning signs that your friends are like this? And I think we went over it pretty accurately. But, you know, again, people are, you know, when they're entrenched in friendships, or people, no, they're not like that. Well, individual Christians also may not be like that. Individual Christians and progressive Christians, as you mentioned, may not follow these values. But that does not mean that their church organization as a whole is exempt from those values. You know, they are not exempt. So an individual Christian may be ignorant as to the full scope of what their church is trying to do, and may look at it altruistically and say, oh, well, we're just trying to do good in the government. We're just trying to do good here and there. We're not out to really capture, you know, what the kinds of things that you were talking about. I think this nightmarish apocalypse. But unfortunately, it is true whether they will acknowledge it or not.
Well, you know, I saw, I think, a perfect example of this on television recently, you know, as, you know, we're leading up to all of these, you know, primary elections, and the media went up to this person and asked who they were going to vote for, and it just happened to be Trump, and they said why, and he gave this vague response, like, oh, he's done so much for the economy, and, you know, I just wish these reporters would say, well, what did he do for you exactly? You know, what did he do, you know, for the middle class? Or are you just believing he's done so much for the economy because he's telling you he's done so much for the economy? You know, it's this critical thinking element that's missing. And, you know, look, it's not just in the Christian communities. It's in the pagan communities, too. I know it's in the goddess spirituality community. And again, another reason why I do these sorts of shows, even if it might ruffle some feathers, because I remember I was working with this couple for a really long time. They were part of the not-for-profit. My husband and I started the Isis Ancient Culture Society. We did for 10 years, and I had no idea they were radical Republicans because it never seemed to come up. And I remember after, I think it was Katrina, one of the hurricanes that devastated New Orleans, my hometown, and all of the news reports were coming out about how these corporations were coming into town and exploiting the workers, paying them less than minimum wage because they could get away with it. And and I had this conversation with this couple thinking, well, of course they would think that, that exploitation was outrageous, but they didn't. You know, they were on the side of the corporation, and I was just blown away. I looked at them in a totally different sense. You know, they said, well, the corporation takes all the risks, and if they're willing to work for that, that's their problem. But, you know, if that's the only job available, I don't think that exploitation is a spiritual thing to do. It's I don't think it's a moral thing to do. And that's why I started talking about reconciling our spirituality and politics, because, you know, I look at goddess ideals as, you know, caring, sharing, equality, you know, a level playing field, creating win-win situations, not domination and exploitation, which is what capitalism is, you know. And so I guess maybe this kind of, you know, brings us back to our topic today. But, you know, and any thoughts about that, Lewis?
You know, it's interesting because lately there's been a battle in the neo-pagan and polytheistic communities about conservatism versus liberalism. And there has been an influx of nationalists in some quarters, such as in Hellenic polytheism, people wanting to claim Greek nationalism and say, you know, well, it's only us, bloodlines, and they're conservative, and their politics are very conservative. They want to push back against liberalism and liberal ideology in their religion. I know there's a lot of racial divide right now in the heathen community, and even political. There's a lot of heathens, such as many in the Theod community, not all, but many in Anglo-Saxon Reconstructionism, who are staunch Republican, who are staunch and will support their own, and are known because of their own mindset on what is religion and hierarchy and values. They feel that the Republican Party is more prone to support their own values rather than liberalism, you know, in the Democratic Party or whatever party that's not Republican. And so it was a shock to me, because here I am thinking all neo-pagans and polytheists must be liberal. And that is not the case. And so that surprised me about how much pushback there is. And especially, as you said, in the goddess spirituality community, and even in some of the Wiccan community. I mean, Wicca is not a doctrine. It's an orthopraxy rather than teaching a doctrine. So you'll have many Wiccans of different flavors, especially in traditional initiatory Wicca, where, you know, you'll have many Wiccans are very different politically. They're very different philosophically, but yet they're able to work together in a coven setting to worship the gods. But there are Wiccans who are very conservative and magicians who are very conservative and feel that the Republican Party or any conservative party, you know, they'll be like, oh, well, they're not, you know, we're Republican, but we're not extreme Republican. Well, currently your party is extreme. So it's either you support it wholeheartedly or you don't. I hate to make it black and white, but they've made it black and white. And this is a battle for our rights, my rights and minorities and marginalized groups are in danger of being trampled on by these conservative right-wing parties. And I don't understand how support can continue for them. But, you know, that's what they do. And so it really is a travesty.
Yeah. Well, and just, you know, one last thought on this, you know, before we jump into, you know, the Christianity's links to capitalism is, you know, I obviously an error in my thinking, I guess, or I don't know, maybe it's an error in their thinking. But, you know, I came to this with the thought that if we're pagans, we all revere the earth. You know, the earth is our mother kind of a thing. And to me, it was very simple. You know, if you support a party that, you know, is going to be, you know, raping the earth and doing this fracking and, you know, letting developers and the oil companies and all of these, you know, companies for, you know, for profit destroy the environment, then, you know, are you really a pagan? You know, are you really about earth-based spirituality? And I don't know, you know, it feels like there's a cognitive disconnect if you say you're an earth-based spirituality and then you will go along and support, you know, these Republican ideas. And look, and also corporatist Democrats. I'm down on corporatist Democrats too because as far as I'm concerned, they're just Republican light. You know, they will, you know, for the sake of money, will rape the earth. And it feels like to me, you know, if we call ourselves neo-pagans, earth-based spiritualists, that, you know, we have to reconcile our spirituality and politics. I mean, I don't know, Lewis, you educate me. To your knowledge, are any of the neo-pagans out there, are they all earth-based spirituality oriented, or is that where the disconnect comes in? I'm just mistaken about that.
You know, there's been a debate right now about, you know, whether or not in the community we should all be, you know, identify ourselves by earth-based spirituality, or there are people who are what call themselves God-centered pagans or God-centered polytheists, meaning that although they understand the importance of protecting the earth, they are not. They don't want to identify solely as these quote-unquote tree-hugging pagans. So they want to be more God-centered, deity-centered, and so they're about surviving traditions and worship and protecting their, you know, the cultists that they've developed towards these gods. And so you know, but in my opinion, I feel that there is a disconnect that it's, you know, your deities, in so many words, were born of nature. Your ancestors understood that. There are some people, however, such as some heathens who, not all heathens, but some heathens, that is Germanic Reconstructionists or Anglo-Saxon or Nordic spiritualists who believe that, you know, it's more about virtues and self and having a warrior aesthetic or having a cultural aesthetic, a tribal aesthetic, as opposed to just being connected only to the cycles of nature, which appears to be something that neo-pagans, especially neo-pagans, seem to have come up with during the 50s and 60s when the Wheel of the Year was invented, you know, and there was this combination of Druidry and Wicca influence that combined together to create the Wheel of the Year under a Druid named Ross Nichols and a Wiccan, Gerald Gardner, who founded Wicca. You know, they came here and they looked at their earth-based spirituality, which was a reaction to the Industrial Revolution, actually. Earth-based spirituality and nature-based medical medical professions such as naturopathy and, you know, essentialism were a reaction to the barbaric practices of the time in Industrial Revolutions and in medicine. And so it was about a return to nature, back to nature. And I think we've forgotten that. We've forgotten our roots so much. So there are some neo-pagans who are very much like that, but then there are other neo-pagans who are like, no, we need to go back to where we come from.
Okay. All right. Well, great conversation here. And so let's go back to the beginning. Were Christians always like this? You know, or was it more of a, I guess, more of a socialistic kind of, you know, it's about the we and the us rather than the I and the me kind of a thing. You know, has it always been this selfishness?
No, it has not, actually. Christianity began actually as a communistic and socialistic, combining the two philosophies, movement. And they lived a common life, and many of them, and to be a Christian meant to voluntarily surrender your possessions. For example, this was some of the things, for example, like in Acts chapter 2, verses 43-45, there is a quote that goes, you know, that everyone was filled with awe at some of the miracles that were performed by the apostles. And so what they did was, under their direction, that all the believers got together and they had everything in common. They sold their property, they sold their possessions, and it was given to anyone in need. All the monies came together and they were distributed to whoever it needed to be. You know, Jesus said in Luke 14:33, each of you who doesn't give up all that he possesses is really incapable of being my disciple. So there's this commandment, there's this idea that Christianity was born to give and to share. And it was a Greek word called koinonia. And koinonia really was translated differently in different parts of the Bible, such as fellowship, sharing, participation. But what it really meant was it was a jointly contributed gift, that was the idea of equality, that was the goal, equality for all members, whether men, women, or children, and that everyone had an equal say, everyone had an equal part to help in these ministries. And unfortunately, what ended up occurring was, Christianity really began to change, with philosophies like Thomas Aquinas, who began to lead a debate. I mean, the Franciscan order. I mean, this was the way the medieval church functioned for quite some time too. Even though the Roman Catholic Church was in charge, church and state were one. Many of the Catholic orders, such as the Franciscans, gave up their possessions and lived together in monasteries and gave to the poor and grew their own foods and lived sustainably. But unfortunately, around, I want to say about the 14th, was it 12th century, 1323, I believe, Pope John the 22nd declared that these kinds of living were heretical to the church because it threatened the establishment. And there was even a debate in the church and a council that came together to debate on whether Christ owned property, to tell whether or not they should follow these commandments on what to give up and to surrender all, or to accumulate some kind of wealth and keep the Pope and the cardinals in power. You know, they kind of forgot that Matthew 6:24, Jesus spoke about, you know, you can't live by two masters. You either live by God or you live by money, by mammon. And so Christianity did not start out how it is now. It became that way because they grabbed onto power to survive. And survival is what prompted their privilege and began the downward spiral of what we have today.
Yeah, yeah. Because I mean, I remember, you know, the beauty of Christianity was the equality. You know, women were priests. You know, the poor, the slave, they all had a place. But that shifted. You know, do you have a date or a date range? You know, when things, you know, started to go bad. I mean, how long was it? This ideal that we're talking about, where, you know, there was equality and there was this sharing and caring rather than this grab for power and money?
I want to say about, you know, somewhere between the 4th century, many of the early church fathers really encouraged this idea of communalism. So I want to say about that to about maybe about the 12th, through the 16th century, so maybe like right on there. So we're talking about a period of at least, you know, at least 10 centuries, you know, at least a millennia. So this was the idea. This was the practice of the church. And again, though, you know, unfortunately, you know, with the rise of church and state, it began to break down around that same time, around the 4th or 5th centuries. But there were still pockets of Christianity that held on to these communal ideals, no matter what, that the political alliance between Catholicism and the state, the Roman state, was more about survival than anything else. And many Christians at that time felt that way. Many of the church fathers in their writings did write about this. And St. Augustine, for example, wrote in The City of God, he wrote, you know, about how it was still encouraged for Christians to not forget where they came from. I guess maybe as a warning also to the inherent powers that be of where they were headed. You know, the Latin church father Tertullian really was one of the movers and shakers behind the power grab that encouraging the power grab that came from the marriage of Catholicism and the Roman Empire. But I want to say it was probably close to about anywhere from 700 years to about 1,000 years that this doctrine in some form or fashion survived.
Okay. So it was around for a pretty long time until it started getting chipped away at and distorted.
That's correct. Yeah, it was. It was very much so.
So, so let's, you know, let's get, you know, let's make it a little bit more relevant. You know, we've sort of established that Christianity was not all of this, you know, not always this predator capitalistic model, or even if you don't want to say predator, you know, which it feels like it is today, it wasn't a capitalist thing. You know, talk about the, you know, why Christianity, you know, was more associated, you know, with capitalism rather than socialism or communism. But I think it was, all right, let me rephrase that. I think early on you said Christianity was more associated with communism and socialism, yes, and then it shifted to capitalism.
That's correct. It had this combination of, you know, communism, communal living, communal sharing, and then socialism, where the ones in charge were able to share what they had in common with those that were in need. And this actually helped the church, this type of economy actually helped the church survive when the Roman Empire was experiencing severe droughts and severe and harvests were not growing properly, and people were becoming poor. They actually turned to the church, to Christian groups for food and for shelter, because the Christians had done this already, and this helped to swell their numbers.
I see. Yeah. And but then things start to shift, and you know, and you've sort of alluded to that. I mean, how does that happen? I mean, how do they go from this? You know, again, the socialist communist model, which I want to address the fact that that comes with such negative baggage now. And, you know, and then they switch over, you know, to capitalism. I mean, that's kind of a big topic, I guess, I'm asking you to explain. But, you know, is there more to the mindset? I mean, more to how that shift happens? And maybe define what socialism actually is, you know, because it seems like, you know, especially the media today wants to demonize socialism. So I turn it over to you to explain it to us.
Sure. Let's define socialism first and foremost. And I mean, you know, there's always been a debate as to what socialism itself can mean. I mean, people are freaked out about the word because they equate it to, you know, because there were people like Karl Marx who talked about socialism, and people equate Marx with Soviet communism, which is completely different. But, you know, in simple terms, socialism really is any system that, you know, the production and the distribution of goods and services is very much a shared responsibility of a group of people. You know, it's based upon this idea of collective sharing. And in the state, and this is where it gets freaky because people are freaked out. In a state of socialism, there is no privately owned property. And that's what Americans want to fight for. You know, well, I have the right to privacy in private property, which is a fact. So, you know, and I completely understand, because I mean, that's one of the guarantees of the Bill of Rights and Declaration was, you know, that we have inalienable rights and we, you know, the right to live life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So, you know, so just exactly what is the true definition of socialism is what I had just mentioned. But really, it's also an economic theory where the money made belongs to the people who actually make stuff instead of a group of private owners. And I think that that's where the confusion lies, is what we're talking about, privacy, privately owned property, is really what we're talking about is the corporations that trade wealth by subjugating the workers and making the profits and them keeping the profits rather than redistributing to the workers. And this really rose in Christianity during the late medieval times after the Pope John the 22nd declared that the Franciscan idea, the Christian idea of communalism was heretical, because again, it was a threat to the state. They wanted to keep their money, they wanted to keep their power. And we see it start rising again and again, no matter what. It trickled down to Protestants as well when the Protestant Revolution started. John Calvin, for example, in the 16th century, talked about how, you know, that there is this idea that there are chosen people, and these people have a right to inherit the earth. They don't, you know, but they were like, you know, meek. The meek have the right to inherit the earth, according to Jesus' teachings. But they felt that being a Christian automatically meant that you have a right to possess the earth and to possess property and to possess people. And so this is why many of the Calvinist denominations, they, when they fled to America, they had no qualms about holding slaves because they were the chosen. And they felt that the slaves did all the work so that way they could turn their minds to lofty spiritual pursuits. But they had no problem doing it because they were the chosen. And this American, and it really took off in American Protestantism. You know, this idea that, you know, there is this notion actually that was written by Adam Smith, who was a Christian and a capitalist. I think he's the father of capitalism, actually, Adam Smith. He wrote a book in 1776 called An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of Wealth of Nations, where he talked about that the interests of greater economy, and this was a Christian-based book because it talked about God and Christ a lot and what the work of Christ was, you know, and the examples it set forth as far as the Bible and doctrine is concerned, is that in the interest of the greater economy, people should not be selfish about their work, but give up their gratification short-term, their short-term gratifications in order to be profitable to the community long-term. And this was, it's called deferred gratification. And it was known as enlightened self-interest, meaning that to do well by doing good, you do act in the further interest of others. And that altruism in and of itself, which is one of the cornerstones of communism and socialism, to be altruistic, was not good because you were not working for the state or for the common interest of the state. You were working for the common good and your neighbors, and this encouraged a type of tribalism which was frowned upon as far as national identity was concerned. So we're seeing the rise of nationalism and patriotism combined with religion and combined with economic theory at this time. And this really took off in the 19th century, where we see capitalism on an imperial scale in many parts of the world, with the rise of capitalistic states and imperial states, where they felt that they were giving democracy, but they were giving democracy to only a chosen few. And we see Christianity as the official religion of those states. And we see imperial powers such as England and France and Belgium, many European powers infiltrating colonies and other countries to make them colonies. And so we see this idea that, you know, they were forcing people finally to give up their original economic theories in favor of capitalism and Christianity.
And I think that's where we end up with colonialism, which, you know, is an evil. I mean, basically, you know, people become slaves, you know, to the capitalist model. You know, it giving up altruism, you know, seems, I don't know, this whole idea seems like justification for selfishness. You know, that it's only a chosen few that are entitled to benefit from, you know, one's toil and effort. You know, the rest of us are just sort of cogs in a wheel that work for the chosen few. I remember I was surprised when I interviewed Richard Wolff, because, again, this was not something we learned in the Bible Belt of the South. I interviewed Richard Wolff, who was an economist, and you can find the interviews, I'm pretty sure, in the archives if you put Voices of the Sacred Feminine, Richard Wolff. You know, he talked about, you know, FDR was forced into creating our social safety net, making provisions for the safety of workers and the benefits of workers by the communists and the socialists and the unions. And, you know, that just blew me away because, you know, I grew up with that idea that, oh, the communists and the socialists, they're the evil people, you know, but if it hadn't been for them and, you know, FDR being pushed, we wouldn't even have Social Security or probably unemployment insurance and a 40-hour week and, you know, all of the different things that we have. And I don't know, I guess I just find it incredulous, you know, that disconnect, you know, that, you know, we want to demonize the communists and the socialists all the time. But it feels like that's capitalist propaganda. I mean, that's not to say that, you know, those systems don't have flaws, but those systems can be, you know, altered and worked against so that they fail. And, you know, it makes it look like it's a failure when it was actually maybe sabotaged. I don't know your thoughts on that. I mean, am I going down a rabbit hole here, or are there some kernels of truth in that?
No, there's some kernels of truth. And speaking of FDR, I mean, and this takes us back to Calvinism. You know, it takes us back to this idea that you know, Calvinism as a Protestant ethic, this idea that there's a chosen and there's a caste system, really became a 20th century American phenomenon as a reaction to FDR's socialist policy. And there were a lot of evangelicals at the time, and many Christians who rose to prominence, preaching the evils of socialism, and that, you know, we were being taken over, that this was the end of the world, you know, and this was the end times that was being preached about. And I mean, we have the rise of tycoons such as, I believe there was a Texas oil tycoon by the name of Sid Richardson, who began to fund evangelicals who favored the Calvinist doctrine that, you know, the harder you work, the more you give up in self-interest, that you're going to accumulate wealth, and those that are less deserving and not chosen don't deserve the wealth that they, and which are mostly were the poor and the disenfranchised and minorities. And so you had people like Sid Richardson who funded people like Billy Graham. Billy Graham became famous just because of Sid Richardson's funding, and behind the scenes. Otherwise, Billy Graham would have been a blip note in history as just another, you know, crazy event, a crazy preacher. But we began to see this, and we began to see how there were movements. There were movements within the church to start pushing for wealth, especially after the Johnson Amendment. Lyndon Johnson signed into the, you know, signed into law that churches don't have to be taxed. And when that happened, there was an explosion of prosperity, Calvinist doctrine, such as the Word of Faith movement in the 70s, where Christians, white Christians, which spread over to minority Christianity, where you could speak and just claim something, almost like the book The Secret. You know, you attract it. You are, you know, holy positivity, and all negativity is to be wiped away from your mindset. You know, Word of Faith, name it and claim it, which of course then led to what's called whole salvation, where you're not saved unless you're not a Christian unless you're also prospering in a wealthy manner. You're healed. You don't have to go to the doctor's office. You know, you have money. It just became a vicious cycle.
So speak to the prosperity gospels, because, you know, it seems to me there's some selfishness and evil. I mean, maybe that's a strong word, but it seems to be, you know, the opposite of what Jesus preached and the origins of Christianity. You know, if I understand it properly, I mean, explain to listeners, you know, sort of that disconnect about the prosperity gospels.
You know, the prosperity gospel is preaches that the core doctrine is that the more you give to the church, the more you give to the ministry, the more money that you invest, God will in turn bless you. And so you have a lot of people who invest in the church, their life savings, or give a lot of money. I know in my family, we ended up we were very poor. We were not a very rich family, but between my dad's Social Security and, you know, all of us combined together, and when I was working hard growing up, we were giving away at least $200 to $300 a week to the church, hoping that we'd receive blessings in return. And there was this blind faith of, you know, even though we didn't have food at home or we didn't have enough money, it was like, oh, no, you know, you'll be fine, because the more you give, that will bless the pastor or the head of the church, the more the blessings come down, because there's the scripture in the book of Psalms talks about the priesthood, and it says that God brings the oil of anointing from the head down. So it was interpreted as an allegory that, you know, the pastor or the head of the church, the more they prosper, the more you'll prosper. And that's just not how it works. And people are stuck in poverty because of it.
Well, that's the prosperity. That's the trickle-down economics we hear about, you know, isn't it? And, you know, it's interesting you're saying that. My husband and I experienced it in Kabbalah. I was really interested in Kabbalah for a while, and we went to classes for a couple years because I was interested because there was so much magic in it. You know, I wanted to see where the connections between Kabbalah and goddess spirituality might be. And, you know, just I experienced that there as well because I had a shoulder injury. And it wasn't healing, and I was afraid that I was headed for surgery. And the teacher that had been assigned to me, it was actually by my third teacher, because I asked so many questions, they kept passing me off to teachers that were higher and higher up because, you know, they didn't like all my questions. But anyway, you know, he said, well, then you're not tithing enough. If you tithed more, your shoulder would heal. Well, you know, that was like such a huge red flag to me, because we had started tithing a lot just to see if that energy exchange would net anything, you know. And it got to the point where there was no more discretionary income to tithe. And I said that to him. And he said, well, get a second job. And I said, I'm going to go get a second job to tithe more, you know, and you're going to promise me that my shoulder is going to heal and I'm not going to need surgery. And I don't know, it was just the insanity of it was so repulsed me that in spite of the fact that there were some great and interesting classes there, I just ran for the hills, you know?
Oh, I don't blame you. Not one bit. I mean, that is a red flag. Give and you'll, and that goes back to whole salvation. Give and you'll be just fine. And that's not how it works.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So where do you want to go with from here, Lewis? Do we want to talk about, you know, what democratic socialism is versus socialism and communism? You know, I don't know, and I kind of want to talk about too this, you know, thanks to, it sounds like, the Protestants, we have this rugged individualism for the individual, but it's, you know, been tweaked where the corporations are the ones that get the socialism. You know, they're the ones that are benefiting from our tax dollars rather than our tax dollars actually going toward our social safety net kind of a thing. You know, where do you want to go from here on this?
Well, I mean, we can talk about democratic socialism and, you know, it you know, how it fares into socialism itself.
Okay.
And democratic socialism, for those who are not aware, it is a political philosophy, and it does support democracy, but the economy itself is socially owned, and I think this is where the disconnect lies. When people think of socialism and communism, they think of places like Stalinistic Russia. And what people don't realize is that that was a totalitarian state married with communist and socialist ideals. I mean, the idea is socialism and communism, these are economic theories. It's the politics that's married to those economies that determines how successful it will turn out for the benefit of the people.
And so that's why when we look at the Scandinavian countries, like, you know, the policies that Bernie Sanders advocates for, we're looking at the Scandinavian countries that have democratic socialism rather than the totalitarian socialism of Stalin.
That's correct, yes. And, you know, we have a lot of examples in the Scandinavian countries about how, you know, they're very socially liberal, and they are they have these things in place, these systems in place to take care of their elderly, take care of the children, take care of their families medically and financially, so that no one is going without.
Right, right. And, you know, I don't know, it's just amazing to me that Americans seem to want to be masochists, you know, that they would normalize their tax dollars go into the military-industrial complex to corporations that don't need more tax dollars while, you know, our social safety net is shredded. You know, and the elderly don't have enough to live on, and, you know, there's no college, there's no health care. You know, it's really just amazing to me that people don't want more for themselves. I quite honestly don't understand it, Lewis.
I don't either. This is again, another disconnect. This is the marriage of emotion and belief, and the more facts you present, the more entrenched people will become in their belief systems. They will refuse. It has to be a change from within. And this is what's the most difficult part, because it's, you know, how do you change from within? How do you convince people to change from within? And it's when they become desperate. It's when people become desperate, which is what's happening now in our country. People are, you know, especially our generation, you know, the younger generation, people are becoming desperate. They are seeing the collapse of the capitalist system and how it just does not work. They are working 2 to 3 jobs. They have no health insurance. I have a very dear friend of mine who does not have health insurance right now, and she's afraid to go to the emergency room to treat a serious illness because she's going to be, you know, how does she afford it? And hospitals, sometimes I've seen bias with a lot of some hospitals. They will turn you away. They will just put a metaphorical bandage on your issue because you don't have insurance. You know, how are they going to get paid? And I mean, not every hospital is like this, but I've seen hospitals do this. You go to the ER, you have no insurance. They won't keep you very long. You're just in and you're out as best as you can be. Whereas people who have insurance are treated much more, I don't want to say the word royally, but they are. They're given rooms, they're treated better, you know, because you have the insurance, you have the money that's going to make it up for it.
Right. Well, and I would caution people, too, to be careful what they listen to on television. You know, they've been running a commercial where I live in Kern County for a while, where this guy is going to talk about the evils of Canadian medicine, that, you know, it's, you know, there's shortages and everybody doesn't have access to it. And, you know, I really believe that some of these people are being paid to spread disinformation, you know, because we know people who live in Canada. We know people who live in the Scandinavian countries, and these things just simply aren't true. I think this is just more propaganda and scare tactics, you know, to keep people not expecting, you know, to have a better quality of life, quite frankly.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. And I mean, people don't realize, I think, that our country was declared, you know, church and state were one in England, and, or are one, and this notion of hierarchy, and, you know, that there is a caste system of wealth and the bottom are poor. And I don't think people realize that our country was founded on socialist ideals, this idea that, you know, all men are created equal. They're endowed with certain unalienable rights, and it's life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. You know, this was a John Locke philosophy that completely overturned the financial notion that, there, you know, wealth is only for a chosen few. And, you know, and this comes back to, you know, what are our values? People have to start asking themselves, what are their values? Where do they stand? Where do they lie? And as a neo-pagan, myself, I believe that there should be something called eco-socialism or democratic eco-socialism, where we begin to see the benefits of eco-consciousness to better our planet, to better the Mother Earth and all her creatures, because we are part of it. We are part of that system. And unless we begin to do something soon, you know, and drastically and radically, we really are in the danger zone. I mean, Mother Earth will survive and we won't, but it really is a fight right now between power grabs of failed capitalism and the rise of people who feel that their own interests are what's more important. So we're seeing a battle between capitalism and socialism at the moment.
Right, right. And of course, you know, the media is owned by corporations. You know, they aren't, you know, out there to teach the public or encourage the public to vote in their own interests. You know, in fact, they do just the opposite. And it concerns me because our educational systems are not teaching people civics or you know, economics or even critical thinking to be able to, you know, make the best decision for themselves and their families. Instead, you know, they're doing what the church tells them from the pulpit or, like you said, make decisions based on emotions or fear. I mean, you know, how many people are voting, you know, for Joe Biden right now out of fear? Because, you know, Bernie Sanders is something new or has been demonized in the media rather than thinking to myself, well, you know what, I want a better quality of life. That's what he's offering. You know, we need to start going in that direction or there's no hope anything will ever change. You know, it's really kind of crazy.
It really is. And, you know, you mentioned the media and the media, you know, as you said, you know, they exchange for money and access. You know, they don't, their attention is, you know, they have 20 seconds to give you the news. And that 20 seconds is given to stuff that is not relevant to people's everyday lives. They will cover something and then they'll move on. They'll cover something and move on. And it doesn't stay in the American consciousness. You know, we've lost the ability, journalists have lost the ability to be effective, to be objectively effective in their work because they have the corporate news entity that they have to please. And the corporate entity gets to choose what's important, what isn't. You know, what's going to grab ratings and what isn't. And it's all about ratings.
Yeah.
It's all about money. And this is a facade. We have a facade of what the media really is.
Yeah, I agree, and it's unfortunate, and nothing, I guess that's why I like doing my show, is because, you know, we can have the follow-up question. You know, it feels like so often these people on television who interview folks just let them spiel their ideas and never question them. You know, they can say anything and get away with it, and by virtue of the fact that people are hearing it, you know, on the television airwaves, I mean, so many people just accept it as truth as opposed to them ever being challenged. And, you know, that's unfortunately sad, and, you know, that's a whole – you know, whole nother problem with the, you know, with the media abdicating their responsibility as the fourth estate. And I mean, and what that means is they were supposed to be the watchdogs of democracy. And instead, you know, again, it feels like to me it's capitalism and greed that have sort of, you know, just weakened the whole, you know, all of the institutions that protect us. And, yeah, it's a huge pervasive problem But the status quo, in my opinion, is not the answer. That's kind of like just you're out in the ocean and you're about to drown and you're just going to keep treading water. You know, at some point you're going to get so exhausted you're just going to, you're just going to succumb and drown rather than maybe, you know, having some courage and swimming to the shore, you know, doing something different. I don't know if that's a good analogy or not, but it kind of just popped into my head. You know, I feel like that's what, you know, some people are choosing. You know, it's more the same rather than a better solution.
Oh, definitely. I mean, and you mentioned greed. I mean, going back to, you know, socialism was a reaction to greed capitalism at that time, which began to rise with the Industrial Revolution. You know, Karl Marx, he's a scary guy, but, you know, hey, you know, his philosophy was, you know, what we're, you know, predicting where we are going. If we continue along this road, it is going to destroy humanity. A man by the name of Peter Drucker, he wrote a book called The Post-Capitalist Society. And, you know, he talks about how, you know, where we need to head now, where the changes need to go in order for us to survive, because it's just not working. It's a failed experiment, and the experiment of capitalism is an utmost failure.
Yeah. I mean, I think about, you know, some of the things that happen over in the Scandinavian countries. I mean, you know, aside from the fact that, you know, they may pay a little bit more in their taxes, but they get so much more for it. You know, health care, child care, free education. You know, there's a 40% rule where, you know, after the government has paid for a woman's education, then corporations have to make space for 40% of women on the board. And corporations balked at that in the beginning, but then a lot of them saw that they benefited from it because, you know, oftentimes women just innately bring a different perspective kind of to the table. You know, I mean, I would sure like to live in a country where I felt like my tax dollars were really going for my quality of life and the social safety net, so I feel like I could retire with dignity, or, you know, I wouldn't go bankrupt if I got sick. I mean, it's just crazy that everything is geared toward making money. You know, this unfettered growth, you know, can't continue. I mean, it's just not sustainable. And I mean, I look at the millennials coming up, and I hope they are our salvation, quite frankly. I mean, so many people want to demonize them, but they're the ones that seem to be willing to take a chance on something new and have the sense that what we've been doing for the last, you know, 40 years hasn't improved the quality of life of, you know, the average person in this country.
It has not. And, you know, you talk about the taxes, you know, in Scandinavian countries, and, you know, on, you know, taxes in this country, you know, whereas people are like, you know, I'm already paying as much. Well, that's why we want taxes on the rich. We want taxes on that percentage. You know, they can afford it. They can afford the 50% to 70% tax rate. You know, nobody needs to live with a gold toilet bowl. You know, that's just ridiculous. I mean, you know, they should be taxed. Their money should go to social programs and build a middle class. But unfortunately, capitalism is all about, you know, the more you work, quote unquote, the more you work or the more you've invested, the higher the standard you live. It's turned around now to where, you know, it's back to trickle-down economics, just like it was in the church. Or it is in the church. You know, as long as the upper part is taken care of, it'll come down. And that's not the case, unfortunately. In Scandinavian countries, you know, the tax rate is high compared to the rest of Europe. But, you know, there is a high personal tax burden on their citizens. But when you look at, you know, the local and national rates combined, they're also flatter than in most other nations. You know, for example, in Denmark, the top marginal tax rate is about, although it's one to about 1.5% times in the national average income, You know, by comparison, the top marginal tax rate in the United States is about almost 10%. It's almost like 8.5 to 10.5 times the national average. And so although they're paying a high tax, it's really not as high as ourselves, but it's also, you know, they're also taxing corporations with a higher income than we are here.
Well, and you know, and that's it, and I mean, it's incredulous that, you know, you and I are probably paying a higher percentage of taxes than the guy who owns Amazon, you know, or Bill Gates, or, you know, these corporations. You know, I mean, that's just insane. And, you know, it just amazes me that something so unfair can be normalized. And, you know, this is another one of my pet peeves, that we normalize this abuse and exploitation. You know, we normalize it, and it just, it makes me a little crazy, Lewis. Well, you know, maybe we're toward the end here. Is there anything we haven't spoken about that I haven't asked Lewis that you feel like you want to, you know, you want to say before we close the interview? You know, I don't know. Did we cover adequately where, you know, the values of neo-paganism fit into all of this? I'm not sure. I just want to make sure I give you enough time if there's any more you know, want to make sure you say.
Oh, yeah. No, thank you again for having me. But one last thing is just, you know, how we implement socialist ethics in our lives. You know, we do have to be involved in the political process, obviously. But with eco-socialism, we do need to be what I call environmentally evangelistic. You know, we need to be more aware of our biosystem, of our collective biosystem as humans, with the nature that survives around us. So, you know, we have to build our own virtues, you know, which includes how we treat others, you know, with social equality. So for people who are, you know, at the express of being controversial, white, cishet, you know, cisgender, heteronormative people, you know, check your privilege. You know, advocate for minorities and women and marginalized groups, you know. And don't do out of Messiah syndrome. Don't go into an African-American church and preach how you're against racism. Tell your white friends. Go into a white church, majority church. Tell people, check your privilege. Make sure that you understand and that you're not mansplaining to women about women's issues. Give them their space. They deserve it. So, until we all begin to work together for the common good, we are going to continue to see capitalist ethics.
Well said, well said. Well, Lewis, thank you very much for being on the show and sharing so much history here because, again, you know, I don't think people immediately equate capitalism and Christianity, and especially if they're a Christian, I think they need to know their history and their roots and maybe, you know, why they're hearing what they're hearing from the pulpit and start to use some critical thinking about, is this really who I am, you know, is this really my values? And just a reminder, I would encourage listeners to go to the search on my show page and look for those interviews I did with Richard Wolff. You know, he really talks about how important it is that we have employee-owned businesses, that we have corporations where we have an employee representative sitting on the board so that when corporations make decisions, you know, employees are considered, and it isn't always just what's best for the shareholders and for the CEOs, you know, the workers who do the work that make the money, you know, they actually, you know, have an interest and, you know, and they're protected as well. And also, I did an interview with Sylvia Federici about this, and it ties in spirituality, feminism, religion with, you know, paganism and capitalism. That would be another good show. If this is a new topic to you or it's a topic that floats your boat. So that's also Sylvia Federici and Richard Wolff. Well, Lewis, thank you so much. Please know I've appreciated all of this, and you know, you're always welcome to come back on the show. You know, if there are other topics that you'd like to share with listeners here.
Thank you again so much. I really enjoyed the time here. I enjoyed being a part of this. I'm very grateful. And I just hope that there's a lot of people out there that understand that they're not alone in their pursuit of happiness.
Thank you. Thank you. Well said. And, you know, we do have to start thinking about our quality of life and our happiness. You know, it's not something that we hear too often. You know, more often we hear this idea of it's noble to suffer and sacrifice. And, you know, I think that just sets the mindset off, you know, to exploit us down the road in our life, and then we normalize it. So just some food for thought. You know, maybe it's obvious. You know, maybe I'm just preaching to the choir here, but I wonder how many people actually think about that. So, you know, so there it is. Well, thank you, Lewis. And, you know, May, November come round this year, and we have good things to look forward to, I guess is all I can say.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So mote it be.
Okay. So mote it be. All right, listeners, before I leave you today, just a quick word here from Joe Carson. Please stick with me.
Hello, let me say a few things about Joe Carson's film, Dancing with Gaia, an exploration of Earth-based spirituality shot at sacred sites around the world. Here is what Drusilla Pettibone said on DearMist.com. I was truly touched and even awed by the film. I don't think I can comment on it adequately until I've had a chance to watch it a couple more times. I really appreciate that there is so much substantive information to digest. For example, the info about henges and tracing the horizon line is all new to me and totally fascinating. The film was obviously very beautiful, and I was amazed how it was able to capture so many of the descriptions visually and seamlessly connect vintage footage with modern. I especially loved when images were dynamically superimposed on each other, like the lace with the water, and the dancing in the flowering meadow. A visual feast, and with so many layers. I am also so pleased to have been introduced to Monica Shu and her work. It's so important for pagans to become aware of our heritage. It seems easily lost among so many new books, and the film really brought me home in a new way. Dancing with Gaia is available at dancingwithgaia.com.
Okay, so dancingwithgaia.com. Please be sure you check that out. And one last thing that that commercial sort of triggered for me, I want to share with you, is you know, I am an Ancient Alien fan, and while I don't swallow all of it, I am really interested in Zachariah Sitchin, the 12th Planet, as well as some of the Von Doniggin stuff. I mean, again, not all of it, but I find a lot of it intriguing. Anyway, there was an episode very recently where they talked about sacred sites, as Joe Carson is talking about, and they talked about the vibration that they find at these sacred sites is 110 hertz. And, you know, I'm a big sacred sites person. I mean, I wrote Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations, about sacred sites all around the world. So when I heard that, my ears perked up. And because I certainly know when I went in the hypogeum, there was something incredible going on there. And some of the sacred sites are more potent than others. You know, some feel like maybe they've been stripped of their of their potency, but some not so much. And so anyway, this 110 hertz idea, this vibration that they were talking about at a lot of these sacred sites, well, that, you know, that piqued my interest. So I wanted to see what that sounded like. So I went on YouTube and looked through a few offerings there of examples of 110 hertz. And one in particular that I liked was a singing bowl, which was somehow tuned to 110 hertz. And I'm just sharing the results here with you. It's something I'm still actually researching. But I probably sat there with headphones and listened to this 110 hertz, I want to say 30, 45 minutes, something like that. Then I went on to other things. And what I found remarkable, and I can't tell you if it's a coincidence because I haven't experimented with it, you know, regularly, but what I thought was so profound, if it wasn't a coincidence, was that night I had the most vivid dreams. And not only were the dreams vivid, but my deceased grandparents, who had been deceased for more than 20 years, they actually came to me in this dream and spoke to me. I had never had that happen before. And I can't help but wonder if it was that 110 hertz that, you know, put my receptivity into a different place. So anyway, just sharing, you know, maybe you find you want to explore that as well. I don't know. If you do, please report back. I would love to know if it works for you or not, if you get anything from it. Okay, well, that about does it for me for this week, dear listeners. I will be back with you, of course, next Wednesday. And I'm going to have with me Hamasa Devi, Claudia, who's calling in from the UK. She is part of the, I don't know if I'm going to pronounce it right here, the Tuatha De Danann. I'm trying to look for it because I can say it better if I actually see it. But it's going to be that, you know, those early folks who lived in Ireland, you know, and, you know, we're going to be talking about that history of the Tuatha De Danann. And forgive me if I am pronouncing that incorrectly. I don't think I've ever actually heard anyone say it properly, and that's part of the problem. But we're going to talk about who they were, you know, because I think they're probably pre-Druid, the indigenous people of, I think, Scotland, Ireland, Wales, and you know we're gonna delve into that. I know there's a, you know, a group that was part of the Fellowship of Isis, and that's who our guest is, and you know they have been practicing this for many, 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 many years, and I think she is going to be a really great expert on the subject, and it's not something that we've talked about here on the show in a while, or if ever, quite frankly. So anyway, thank you for tuning in today. I want to thank again Reverend Louis Valadez for this week and last week's show. Please share it with your friends. I believe it is so important in this election year. And as I've said before, thank you for your donations. Now that I am retired and taking care of my husband at home with a brain injury, your donations mean that much more. You know, because I'm not able to work as I was before, which funded, you know, my goddess-oriented practice. So if this has been a spring that feeds you, I hope if you can help with donations, you know, to keep the show on the air, that that you will. All right. Well, thank you very much, and I will be back with you next Wednesday. Until then, blessed be, and may Goddess embrace you in her golden wings. Good night.